This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special for Women's History Month. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
More dangerous than 1,000 rioters, Lucy Parsons was an African, Native, and Mexican-American revolutionary anarchist labor activist from the late 19th and 20th century America. Emerging out of the Chicago Haymarket Affair of 1886, in which 8 anarchists were imprisoned or hung for their beliefs, Lucy Parsons led tens of thousands of workers into the streets in mass protests around the country. Defying both racial and gender discrimination, she was at the forefront of movements for social justice her entire life. She sparked rebellion and discontent among poor and exploited workers wherever she spoke, and her fiery, powerful orations invoked fear and authority nationwide. This is a tribute to Lucy Parsons, her work, and the causes she championed. May she continue to serve as an inspiration in the ongoing struggle for peace, justice, freedom, and democracy. More dangerous than 1,000 rioters, Lucy Parsons. And now excerpts from the new play, A Day of Reckoning, about the life of Lucy Parsons. And with us is Lorca Perez, founder of Multistages and director of Day of Reckoning, and Melody Cooper, award-winning actress and playwright of Day of Reckoning, Freedom Bradley, who plays Albert Parsons Jr., and Michael Canale, who plays Albert Parsons Sr. in A Day of Reckoning. Welcome to Building Bridges. Lucy Ella Gonzalez Parsons. Melody Cooper, how did you create the play and the character of Lucy Parsons?
I came across Lucy when I was researching something else online, and I came across this site that described who she was. I'd never heard about her. I never remember learning about her in school. And here was this woman of color who is so involved in the labor movement, and I became fascinated by her. She was a former slave and married to Albert Parsons, who I also didn't know very much about, who was an ex-Confederate soldier, and that really piqued my interest. How did these two people end up together? And also learning about Albert was fascinating because I didn't know much about the Haymarket riot, and that kind of set the fire for me.
I'd like to say that Melody's play came to me. I'm the director and the artistic director of Multistages, which is a small theater company. We held a competition every 2 years, and we're reading all these fabulous plays, which are all multidisciplinary. That's part of our mission. And here comes this marvelous play that is not only political, it's beautifully written, and it also has film and puppetry in it. And we just all went, this is our winner. And so we're really excited to be producing this play for the first time. It's a world premiere, and we have a wonderful cast of actors. We have Freedom Bradley.
That's what got me into the play, was the multidisciplinary aspects of the play.
Number one, that it was a great, that the story, when I read the sides, they were really interesting, and it was very much piqued my interest on that level. But then when I heard that we would have the slideshow, that when I looked through it and I saw that there would be films and clips, and that I'd get to play different age ranges and the clincher was the puppets.
You gotta have puppets. Yeah. You know, there's not enough puppet shows anymore.
well, that was part of the – for writing this piece for me was and I didn't want to do a linear story just with historical fact. I wanted to really find something that moved between – time and place and played with the form and made it more interesting for me and I thought probably for whoever wanted to work on the play and the artists who would be involved in it. And I thought it brought the story more to life to move around more and to use different disciplines in creating it.
Also, one of the other disciplines that's involved, obviously, in theater on stage is music. And one thing that I found was, I think, is very important is to try to bring in music, of course, of the time period. But I'm also interested in bringing in music by African-American composers. One of my favorite composers is George Antheil. And he's a marvelous composer. And one of his most well-known pieces is called Ballet Mécanique. And I'm actually going to be using in the play selections of this piece that was conducted by my father, which is kind of fun, Maurice Paris. I have to say his name, Maurice Paris, and so I have permission to use his material. And this was actually a reconstruction of a concert done at Carnegie Hall in 1927. So we're going to be using sections of that in the play for the puppet show. And the Haymarket Riot is quite fabulous. It's with all these player pianos and sirens going, and it's very dramatic.
You said there were seven player pianos that were set
up in this? I believe that there are seven. Yeah, but the whole stage is covered with player pianos and all kinds of outrageous non-instruments like fans and, you know, John Cage got into a lot of that too. So this is 1920s. Okay, in addition to that, I wanted to use some pieces by Duke Ellington, some that are not as well known as others. Black, Brown, and Beige, for example, the Black, Brown, and Beige Suite is also quite fabulous.
And for me, Michael Keneally, who's playing Albert Parsons, growing up in Chicago, the Haymarket riots were something that I had heard about. There were stories that had basically been forgotten. And so when I had seen that this play was being cast, it really piqued my interest because of that reason. And doing the research, looking into the history of it, it was such a turning point in that time period with the labor movement that I think it's right now with the way the current events are going along, it applies to it so much to it.
Yeah, that's definitely how – because I've been involved in so many protests over my life from when I was in a stroller with my parents. And I take – I have children and I take them to so many different protests, whether it's Matthew Shepard or Amadou Diallo. They have been out there with me. And Albert and Lucy brought their children with them on their protests. So there were a lot of similarities that fired me up in reading about them. And there were a lot of similarities politically. I mean, they talk about elections in ex-slave states. Well, we know that Florida is an ex-slave state. And we know what happened with elections there. They talk about after the bomb went off at the Haymarket riot, the police made raids without warrants. They let the law go by the wayside. And we know that with the Patriot Act, we have some of that going on now. So there's a lot of similarities I found between, you know, what happened then and what's still going on now.
Right. I mean, the fact that we're, like you're saying, with our civil rights being attacked by the Patriot Act and also the correlation between our war on terrorism now and the whole idea of anarchists hiding bombs in their pockets and lurking around dark corners happened after the Haymarket riot, that these suddenly were creating this image of, you know, you never know that the post office is going to be bombed next. You know, we've got to make an example of these people.
One of the things that fascinates me the most is she was a woman. You're dealing with the late 1800s. Here was a woman of African ancestry, a woman who also had Mexican and indigenous blood as well, but this was a woman anarchist. What did it mean to discover and write about and bring to life, since you're also acting, this figure of a woman at this point in time?
Well, it was very exciting because it's something that we, I think, as I said, I've been an activist myself, but not to the extent that she was. She was, for a woman and a woman of color in that time period, it was dangerous. She was putting her life on the line trying to get black men to register to vote in Texas during Reconstruction. She was putting her life on the line when she went on labor strikes and was organizing in Chicago. And she, the vibrancy of her dedication to her cause really, I felt, put me to shame. And I thought, what a great opportunity as a writer to get inside this woman and figure out who is she, and as an actress, because as a woman of color as an actress, there are not a lot of great roles. And I decided to stop waiting around for them and write one for myself. So the opportunity to play this character
<Your hair>.
was,
was do for self. Yeah.
Yeah, you gotta write yourself a job.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
And to present a role model.
Yes.
I think that's a major thing, not only, you know, a female role model.
Mm-hmm. In ways, because, of course, Lucy has a lot of different aspects to her. She has faults and she has, I mean, she's, I don't know if well-rounded is the right term, but she has her, there are negative aspects to her personality and her behaviors. And there's also amazing, beautiful, tender moments that she has. And she fought for, wonderful causes. So she's an icon and she's also a human being. And that also interested me because I was not interested in writing or portraying someone who is a saint. I wanted to present someone and play someone who is a full human being.
That actually brings up a couple of things that I'd like to talk about regarding the play. One of the very interesting points that Melody brings up in the play is Lucy's relationship to her children. She has biracial children. She has two children that are her and Albert's. And she has a lot of difficulty with her relationship with her son. And I just kind of want us to talk a little bit about her relationship to Albert Jr. I don't know, Freedom, you want to address that?
Even this whole term, you know, just her having a son at the time and him being biracial, you know, black back then, there wasn't, you know, this big biracial. It was you were black, you know, at that time. So
Octoroon.
You know, yeah, an Octoroon. And just to look at him from that perspective, when you're looking at him, he has all these wonderful contradictions as well, because he is the son of these two extremely militant people. And he, in turn, doesn't go that way. He turns and he says that that's your struggle. That's your life. You know, my life, let me define who I am as a person. And that's a very interesting aspect of being able to portray him. This woman and man, they have a child, and they believe in all these individual freedoms. But then again, when they have a son, they want him to follow in their footsteps that they've set out, as opposed to him going out and, you know, trying to tread the earth on his own.
And his name is Albert Parsons Jr., so they didn't
get
much chance for individuality.
The legacy continues.
Yes. It does. So it's like, and just by even having that name, you know, he's going to be walking along a certain path that'll be pretty hard to live up to. You know, it's almost impossible to live up to the light of your father. You have so much defined for you being the son of someone like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
You mentioned a moment ago, Melody, Haymarket, but I'm not sure all of our listeners know what Haymarket is and what role Haymarket played in shaping a particular point in Lucy Parsons' life. So maybe mm-hmm. you can give us a sense of Haymarket. And Albert, of course, was martyred as a result of Haymarket, but maybe you can mm-hmm. set that up for us and give us a sense of that vital period of Lucy Parsons' life.
Albert and Lucy were very heavily involved in the labor movement in Chicago in the mid-1800s, and they were instrumental in setting up the 8-hour day march that happened May 1st in Chicago and across the whole country, where hundreds of thousands of people marched, and there was a huge strike for an 8-hour day, because up until that point, people were working 16-hour days and not getting much pay for it. I guess there was 2 days after that, I think, the McCormick Reaper plant. There was a strike there, and the police used force and killed a number of people. The day after, there was a protest called in Haymarket Square in Chicago to protest police brutality and to further the cause, the labor cause. And a bomb went off during this peaceful protest. There was no violence, though battalions of police were sent in to the protest, though there was no violence. And a number of people were rounded up, including Albert Parsons, and a number of people who were heavily involved in the labor movement and were considered radicals, people who were called anarchists. And that was basically the Haymarket riot and the result.
But the tragedy of the whole event is the fact that Albert Parsons, along with his other comrades who were arrested for this, were not even at the rally at the time. A number of them never even went there. Some of us, as I speak in the first person, actually had already left the rally at that point. It was dispersing when the police came marching in. And these guys were executed based on their ideas. It had nothing to do with the guilt about them throwing a bomb at the police and police being killed. It really came down to anarchy was on trial here. And the prosecutor said that directly to the jury, said to them, this is not about whether they threw the bomb. This is about these men trying to change our institutions.
And it wasn't just even just anarchy. It was really big business. It was afraid of the 8-hour day movement. I mean, you think about it, when you look at the timeline, a few days before this bomb was thrown by some mysterious bomb thrower, there was a huge 8-hour day movement, and big business and the bosses during the industrial bosses during that time were very, very nervous about that movement and what it would mean for their profits. So they really were not happy with these anarchists, and they wanted to get rid of them.
Michael goes from being Michael to being Albert. So we're going to give him the opportunity and you all the opportunity to do that. And maybe we can do one of the scenes. Which one shall we choose? Lorca?
It would be nice to do the first scene when they've just recently met. They've been working together for a little while. And he actually kisses her on the forehead. And we have this wonderful scene that ensues.
I just want to add one thing. They are 19, about 20 years old, and 17 years old. He's a little bit older, maybe 21. So they're just to give you a sense of how old they are. Albert, I don't know what to say.
Well, I've tried to start over again, and it seems like the best things that ever happened to me happened right here in Waco. My print shop, my political work, you.
It's getting late. I should go.
I've made mistakes, and I haven't had a chance to get to know you better, but I'd like to change that.
I'll see you at the meeting tonight.
You might think I'm trying to make up for something.
Albert, you don't have to say
You
all
might
of
think
this.
I'm crazy, but I can't help how I feel.
Oh, Lord.
Well, you do think I'm crazy.
It crossed my mind.
I feel more sane than I did 6 years ago when I was killing boys my age, trying to keep slavery alive.
Albert, save the speeches for tonight. I'm tired. Can't this wait?
I'm talking about you, Lucy. You and me.
Albert Parsons, just stop right there. You think I haven't seen you looking at me lately? Just stop thinking about it. Ain't gonna happen.
Do you like my name?
What?
I'm not interested in going to bed with you, Lucy. Well, actually, I am, but not at the moment.
I don't understand.
Will you marry me? Don't answer just now. Think about it.
You are crazy. You hardly know me, and I'm
a Negro?
That's not what I was going to say.
And I'm white. Just think about it. If you say yes, we'll wait for a while. Give us a chance to get to know each other better.
You can't be serious.
We can talk about it later. It'll be getting dark soon, and I want to make sure you get to the meeting safely. Just think about what I asked.
You are serious.
As I've ever been.
White boy, you are damn strange and downright out of your mind.
Good night, Lucy. Wait. I want you to have this. A woman who was nearly my mama gave it to me.
In the world with this love and this charm and this unlikely pair coming together, did Albert Jr., how is it that Lucy Parsons commits, we're looking at her family side now, how does she commit a son who wants to go and fight in the Spanish War, which she disagrees with, at the age of 19, to a mental institution, never visits him again, and leaves him there until he dies at the age of 39. Mm-hmm. Melody, and then, of course, Freedom's got to relate to how he feels and he understands that reality. The motherless child, in effect.
When I was writing the play, I originally started writing it as just about Albert and Lucy because I didn't know about the son. And someone from Cornell sent me some material on the son, and I was floored when I read it, and it took me a while to really understand how this woman could do this to her son. And then as I began to understand Lucy better and write the play more, it just became clear to me that this is a woman who lost her husband. She worked all her life to clear his name. She was obsessively in love with her husband and their cause. And their son, I think, represented to her what she – everything that she wished her husband could have been if he had lived, she wanted her son to be. And when her son decides to join this war, which she did not support, Roosevelt was at that time supporting that war, and he had called for execution of anarchists. So he was a person who would have called – did call for the execution of her husband, and here her son was joining that war. She felt that was a betrayal. But beyond that, she wanted to control, I think, what was happening to her in her life, because she lost her husband, and not long after that, her young daughter, Lulu, died. And here her son was going to go off to war and maybe die. And by putting him away and committing him, taking away his freedom, ironically, she could have some kind of control over the pain in her life, I think.
And the son also, he doesn't want to be, you know, a cardboard cutout of his father. Everyone wants to see who they are as their own person and have a chance to walk out and strike out on their own. And for her to put so much to invest so much of her own feelings to make this boy the exact image of her father, and for him to never have to grow up, you know, like you see it sometimes, you know, like as a JFK Jr., you know, that he has to be this certain way, or, you know, and in my case, Albert Parsons Jr., that I have to be this certain way. The best way for him to strike out at his mother to say that I want to be something different, or to strike out, because that's what we're talking about as a family relationship, is to say, well, I'm going to turn my back on everything that you may hold sacred, and this is what I would like to do.
Ironically, she kept an urn of his ashes on her mantle until she died in a fire.
We have a wonderful scene. It's a perfect time, perfect segue. It all is actually very self-explanatory now that we've set up the relationship between the two of them.
You can't do this. I'll die here.
Oh, but my dear brave boy, I thought you were so willing to give your life up for the Navy. This is my way of keeping you out of that little war in the Philippines.
It's my choice. It's my life.
Not according to the law. Until you're 21, you're my property.
Your property? I'm your son.
Really? Would my son enlist to slaughter innocent people? Would my son follow orders from Roosevelt, the man who called for men like your father to be executed? Would my son be such a disgrace to everything his father stood
for? Yes, Mama, I'm a disgrace. Because I'm not my father.
Well, you're right about something for once.
Man, he fought the good fight.
Yes.
I don't want to fight this war. I don't want to fight his war. I'm 19 years old and I want to fight this one.
What is wrong with you? You've stopped going on marches. You don't help me try to clear your father's name anymore.
Daddy's dead, Mama. He doesn't care anymore.
I care. And you should care. I don't know who you are. No son of mine is going to make a mockery of my husband.
Dead husband! Ever since Daddy died, I've been nothing in your eyes. You know what? I wish he was here. I wish he'd have gotten over his goddamn pride, asked for your forgiveness, and gotten his sentence commuted. Then you'd have had the husband you wanted, and I would have had a father.
Your father would never give up, never back down. You've learned nothing, Albert Parsons Jr. You don't deserve your father's name.
Mama, you can't put me here. This place is for crazy people. I'm not crazy.
Oh, yes, you are.
You can't prove it.
I'll just tell them you pulled a knife on me, your own dear mother.
But that's not true.
Oh, you are so stupid. Of course it's not true. Oh, your father wasted his love on you. You've betrayed me and your father's memory. Now look what I have to do.
Mama!
You will never leave here. And I will never see you again.
Thank you.
painful, the complexity of the human condition, the complexity of Lucy.
We have to examine a little bit about who she is, because I think that here we are talking about a woman who grew up with her parents as slaves. She was released from her slavedom at the age of 4 or 5, and she went through years of going from place to place as a young person. We have a moment in the play where there is an attack that had happened to her as a child. So we're looking at somebody who's had a really horrific life. So I think that if we start to examine who she is and the psychological damage that this woman has gone through, then she loses her husband to something that, as a victim to a horrific, horrific... there's a great scene in the play that Melody writes where she's trying to bring the children to say goodbye to him. And they won't let her say goodbye. They won't. They won't let them come into the cell
before the execution.
Yes, and yeah. And yeah, so they strip search them and they put them in a cell. And there she is with her 2 children who are 8 and 6 years old. So you're dealing with tremendous amounts of trauma, trauma after trauma after trauma. Then the little girl dies 2 years or 1 or 2 years right after Albert dies. And she's on this insane mission. Her obsession becomes so great to try to give him – it's not clemency anymore. He's dead, but to basically clear his name so that by the time Albert Jr. comes to her and says, I am no longer fighting your fight, the abandonment is so great that I think we have to just sort of examine the psychological damage done to this woman and why she does what she does.
And I think she's in a way, though I know she'd never like to think of herself this way, a victim of a lot of different forces. And I think there is a level of obsessiveness that she had about her love for her husband and her love for the cause.
And she also is fighting so much for her dignity as a woman, her dignity in her race, her dignity, even though she denies that's who she is, but she, it's still a part of her. Even though you deny who you are, it's still
what do you
something
mean
that
she
you
denies
carry around.
Who? She well, is, because we haven't spoken about the whole issue of identity as a woman of African ancestry.
In Waco, Texas, where she was living, there were many incidents of African Americans being lynched and women were being attacked and raped and killed. So she, as a survival mechanism, made a choice because she was of mixed race heritage. She decided to deny her African heritage because it was so painful and it was so dangerous for her. And if she could, she would do what she could to survive. And it's a kind of a twisted way of needing to survive, but it's what she did. And unfortunately, she reaped a really, I think, a sad and tragic result from that.
Mm-hmm. This kind of segues, I think, also into the scene between you and Albert where they're in bed and they have the attack outside because he is married to a black woman and he is out there trying to get blacks the right to vote and he is passing out leaflets in the street. And I think there's a really great scene there in the play that really brings the two of them together and we see the fight that they have and what they have to do, to, what they're fighting against.
All right. I scared them off and put out that damn cross.
Okay. I'm okay. They're gone?
Yes. They've been terrorizing folks all over town, but they won't be coming back.
How do you know that?
I made it clear that I'd shoot them if they do.
They don't shoot you first. You have to stop.
Stop what?
Those election leaflets. You have to stop giving them out.
It's too late now.
I don't understand. You are Secretary of the State Senate, Albert. Can't you get the Senate to do something?
Lucy, some of the men I work with are Klan sympathizers, if not out-and-out members.
They're going to kill us.
It won't come to that.
We can't even walk down the street together. All they see is how brown I am. I thought that being married to you would... Well, I thought things would be different. Our marriage ain't even legal. what would happen to our children if we ever had children. I'm so agitated, I can't get a child.
Don't worry so much.
Don't worry? They break our windows in the middle of the night and set fire to our house and you say don't worry?
It won't come to anything. They've been terrorizing folks all over town.
You just don't want to see the truth, do you? They are going to kill
us. They just want to scare us.
Like they scared Daniel?
Daniel? What are you talking about?
They lynched Daniel.
What?
2 nights ago.
Oh, Jesus. Why didn't you tell me?
I tried. I just couldn't put words to it. Do you know why they lynched him?
I can guess.
Because he was waving one of those damn leaflets around in the next town, trying to get folks to register there, trying to be a hero. 14 years old, and no damn common sense, just like you.
This has got to stop.
Hasn't it, though?
Don't you understand what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to create some political power for you.
For me?
Yes, for Negroes, for you.
I am not I keep telling you, I am not.
Not what? Can't you even say it? Least of all with me.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, you do. I love you for who you are.
Yes. Yes, I know that.
I'm doing all this election work so we can vote the Jim Crow laws out.
That's if the Klan would ever let us get to the polls. What makes you think our ballots would count in any election in any ex-slave state?
Oh, so should we just sit back? Just give up on what Daniel and countless others suffered and died for?
Don't you see? Voting will never make any damn difference. Not for people who never got the land they were promised. That land would have given us power, real power, a place of our own, income, something to work, something to build on. After 200 years of breaking our backs and souls on the white man's land, black folks should at least have a chance to work it for ourselves. If we could do that, own land across the country, then we could build lives, families, businesses, towns, cities. Then, Albert, then we'd have power.
What is land compared to your rights as a human being?
Tell that to Daniel Tanner.
I can't talk to you right now.
Because it's the truth?
Because you won't see any way but your own. You're stubborn and willful.
Yes, that's why you married me. What are you doing?
I'm getting my gun.
No.
He's dead because of me.
You didn't put that rope around his neck.
Didn't I?
No. You did not. These are dangerous times, and we live amongst dangerous, evil men. You are not one of them.
I want to kill something.
Come to bed.
I want to kill someone.
After you kill one of them, they'll kill you, and then they'll come for me. Come here. Come. Let's push it back. Push it away. With all the love we have, we can do that. Come on. Rain kisses on me and wash that hateful fire away. That's right. They can't touch what we have with their hate. No, not me. Not you.
Since we're talking about someone who had a pivotal role in labor, how did she take up the issues of the labor movement? Certainly we know that Lucy Parsons was active in trying to save the Scottsboro Boys, and despite her renunciation for whether it was for issues of identity or survival of her own essence, as a woman of African ancestry, she was deeply immersed in the civil rights and the human rights movement. But how did she get involved, and what is her spirit and her energy about the workers' movement?
Well, I think she saw the labor movement as not being, because we're looking at it from our the distance, our prism looking back. But at the time, I think she saw that as a civil rights and a human rights issue, too. Because they, you know, Lucy and Albert arrived in Chicago, there had been a depression going on. The railroads were very powerful and had expanded across the country. And then there was a standstill and all these people out of work. So they arrived in Chicago seeing scores of people out of work. People were crammed into these tenement homes. And I think they just saw here was a new cause. Here was something that else that we could fight for, because they had just come from Texas, chased by the Klan out of Texas, where they had been working for black voters' rights together. This cause just set them on fire. They fought for exploited workers' rights, for the unemployed, and you know, these are issues that are still, you know, at play today.
They saw the labor issue as being a way to actually go after their social initiatives.
Yes.
Because socialism was now Albert Parsons' passion.
Yeah.
And they saw that if they could help change the 8-hour movement, that would help them along with the greater picture, which was the revolution that was going to turn it into a socialist society, which is what he wanted.
They didn't see anarchy as being a dirty word. It was a way for people to live cooperatively. And for them, the idea of unions, labor unions, was epitomized that. It was the role model for living cooperatively. They loved that.
And it was interesting because anarchy and anarchist was a derogatory term that was applied to them by the capitalist papers. I mean, they were called anarchists, and they decided they were like wearing it as a badge of honor.
Right.
It's like, okay, fine. You want to call us anarchists? We're anarchists then.
Because they were social revolutionaries, socialist revolutionaries, I think is how they originally referred to themselves. David Shipler's book, The Working Poor. Reading that book, it's a great preparation for doing this play, because I get fired up reading it. It gets me angry. I cry while I read it, and you see these people who are out there working their ass off, and they are dirt poor. And the system and the situation that Albert and Lucy were fighting so many years ago is still in existence. This subset of people still exists. I can just imagine how when they encountered this then, how it just – they just said that we've got to change this, and we have the answer.
And when Albert Parsons was executed, he saw himself as a martyr to die for his convictions, mm-hmm. for these causes. But he really thought that this social revolution was imminent. He figured this is going to happen, and it never did, at least not here.
Mm-hmm. Well, the play is clearly historic, contextual, and topical, and hopefully for all who see it will spark the wonder of committing oneself to the enhancement of the human condition. And I know that you have a scene also that deals with the issues of labor organizing.
We have actually two scenes, which we could almost do back to back. The first one is a strike. This is about the May Day March, and it's actually set up by Albert Parsons Jr. And then the second scene following that is actually just sort of a recap of exactly what happened during the Haymarket riot. There's a wonderful monologue that both Albert Jr. and Lucy do in the play. And then we go right into the courtroom drama. Now, what we've done on stage is this is where we get to play with our puppets. So for our radio audience, we need to just sort of visualize what exciting drama might be happening on the stage with all these insane puppets. So when we get to that part, just really have fun with the idea of what could be happening on the stage.
Thank you. The first May Day march. My father helped organize the nationwide 8-hour day demonstrations. I was 7 years old, and I was there.
Eight hours for work.
Eight hours for rest.
Eight hours for sleep.
From Washington and Baltimore.
To Boston, Philadelphia, and New York.
350,000 strong. 80,000 on strike in Chicago alone.
If you work by the piece or you work by the day.
Reducing the hours increases the pay.
We declare war on the 16-hour day.
Big business doesn't like what it's hearing.
Fear is in the air.
But it's not the revolution they expect.
But it is a revolution.
In case you've never heard of the Haymarket riot, here are the facts. It was a peaceful and sparsely attended protest that mostly had dispersed. It was raining so hard, Mom and Dad had taken me and my sister inside to a hall nearby. Then, 200 police suddenly marched in. We heard an explosion. One policeman was killed instantly. 6 police died later of their wounds. 70 officers were wounded, many by their fellow officers' bullets in the confusion that followed. 50 protesters were shot or clubbed by police. Several were killed. No one knew who threw the bomb, but my father was right. They were looking for men like him, and that's why he ran away.
The police made raids throughout the city. The state attorney publicly announced, "Make the raids first and look up the law afterwards." The police threatened me and the children, trying to find out where Albert was. They arrested anyone with even the slightest suspicion of radical activities. The arrests were made without warrants. Many of the accused were beaten while in custody. There were 31 indictments. Only 8 stood trial for murder.
Dad felt guilty that he'd run off after the riot and left his friends behind to face trial. And he couldn't stand being out of the spotlight, so he turned himself in.
Your Honor, if you are going to try innocent men, I will not stand by in silence. I appear in this court of my own free will and voluntarily surrender myself. Your Honor, I request a separate trial.
Denied!
The jury was handpicked by a special bailiff. This bailiff was appointed by the state attorney who was prosecuting the case. Needless to say, the jury was extremely biased.
Biased.
12 men, good and true.
Biased.
All the jury members were prominent businessmen who had openly stated that they were against the labor movement. One was a relative of the dead policeman.
Biased.
The special bailiff made a public statement.
I'm managing this case, and I know what I'm about. These fellows are going to be hanged as certain as death.
I request a new trial.
Denied!
The mayor himself testified that he had been at Haymarket Square.
I saw no weapons. I mean, it was quite possible. I left during Mr. Parsons' speech and told the police captain that nothing was happening nor looked likely to happen that would require the police.
Witnesses testified that Police Captain Bonfield ordered a battalion of police for the peaceful protest and was eager to use force on strikers.
The trouble is that they get their women and children mixed up with them and around them and then in front of them. And then we can't get at them. Oh, I would like to get them in a crowd without their women and children, and I would make short work of them.
There is no evidence that any of us threw a bomb, or that we had any intention to throw a bomb.
The state's case was built on the far-fetched notion of a secret conspiracy mysteriously connected to an unknown, never-identified bomber that no one had ever seen. To make matters worse, the judge's rulings and remarks were blatantly biased towards the prosecution.
Biased.
They're guilty! That one's married to a Negro.
Objection!
Deny!
Hang them!
The press attacked the 8 defendants as dangerous, rampaging enemies of the state.
Arrest that woman over there for not believing in God.
It's my right, goddammit!
Order! Order! This is clearly an overall plot to destroy the entire city of Chicago.
Even our old friends at the Knights of Labor said Albert should be made an example for the government. The verdict?
Guilty of being accessories before the fact to the murder of policeman Matthias Deegan by means of a bomb.
The sentence.
Oscar Niebe, 15 years in prison. Each of the other defendants, in the manner provided by the statute of this state, is to be hung by the neck until he is dead.
Samuel Fielden, 40-year-old teamster.
Louis Ling, 20-year-old carpenter.
August Spies, 31-year-old radical.
Michael Schwab, 29-year-old reporter.
Adolf Fischer, 28-year-old typesetter.
George Engel, 50-year-old radical.
Albert Parsons,
38-year-old typesetter.
Anarchy is on trial here.
Anarchist.
We are being tried for our beliefs.
Father.
We violated no laws.
Husband.
We exercise our rights to free speech, free press, and public assembly.
And the love of my life.
Lucy Parsons, more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. Here's a woman who, in Texas in 1853, is born as a slave. She earns a living as a dressmaker. Her husband is martyred. He's murdered by the state, one of the early political prisoners. What a remarkable woman, committed to anti-lynching law, committed to Scottsboro, to workers' rights. What's the legacy for you, Melody? You wrote the play. You've acted in some ways. As I watch you do the reading, you're transformed. Or are you transformed? Is this part of your persona and your reality? Is there a melding with the spirit of Lucy Parsons?
Yeah, I feel that there is. Sometimes I feel possessed by her. We share the same drive for human equality and that kind of fight for freedom. I remember sitting on my dad's shoulders singing We Shall Overcome. And I know that there's a commonality between what I believe and what Lucy strongly believed. And I think as an actress, I almost feel as if I'm not performing. I feel as if there's an opportunity for me to embody something more than just doing a role, that there's something important to be, I don't want to use the word channeled exactly, but something to give back through my work, not just as a writer, but as an actress. And there's a kind of power that theater has to do that. And so for me, this is a great opportunity, and I'm really happy that Multistages has chosen my play and that it's being produced. And a lot of the work that Lucy and Albert did, it was to crowds. It was to groups of people, and that's what theater can do. You get a group of people in a space, and you get to share this energy and these ideas. And so it's kind of a miniature forum for what they did.
I want to address that a little bit because, first of all, she was her play was the winner of a contest that we held. I mentioned that earlier. And we'd like to find a venue that we think is really appropriate to the particular play that we're producing. I went downtown to the East Village, and I found a wonderful theater on East 4th Street, The Crane, and I said, this is really, it has the intimacy that I'm looking for. The actors can walk into the audience. There's a connection between the audience and the actors. It's small. It seats 98 people, and it just has that kind of feeling that exactly describes what Melody was just talking about. I'd like to just talk a little bit about some of the people that are involved in this production. Because it is multidisciplinary, we have brought in some terrific artists to work with us. One of them is Adam Larson, and he's a video designer, and he's actually a filmmaker. And he's going to be taking all of these incredible drawings and engravings that we've been able to get. thanks to the internet and all kinds of exciting opportunities with, like, the Library of Congress. There are hundreds and hundreds of incredible images of the time period and actually of the Haymarket riot. There were a lot of covers of Harper's Magazine and newspaper cartoons and all kinds of things that we're going to have in the play, and Adam is going to animate these for us. Also, Peter Janis is going to be building the sets and costumes for us. Peter, actually, years ago, was the set and costume designer for Grandma Sylvia's funeral, so that was kind of fun if anybody happened to see that. It's just a really great company of people getting together with, we're all labor activists, we're all in the union, everybody who's involved in this is in one union or another. We all love the cause, and it's inexpensive theater, which is really great, as opposed to all the very expensive theater we have in New York. Just some details about the show, where it's going to be held, and how you can get tickets. First of all, the play is called Day of Reckoning, and it runs from April 14th to April 25th at the Crane Theater, which is at 85 East 4th Street, and that's between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. Tickets are $15, $10 for student, and they can be purchased online at smarttix.com. That's smarttix.com, or by calling 212-868-4444. That is 212-868-4444.
And Freedom and Michael, Albert Jr. and Albert Sr., what has it meant to play these characters, to be in this play with its multifaceted and dimensional, multidisciplinary aspects, and with such a wonderful stage director and such a very fine playwright?
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, like, you salivate to play roles like this that have so many different layers on top of them, and that you're able to have something that's also just so relevant to the way that you feel as a human being, you know, because so much of the stuff that we wind up doing is just stuff. It's great that we come along, and it was just a blessing to even be found by Lorca and her vision, you know, and to come in on this. I care about injustice, you know, wherever
right.
it is, and that's what this play is about. It's about historical people, and it's about a historical event, but it's not really a historical play. It's a play that very much that is going on right now outside of your door if you open up the newspaper and read between the lines. So that's what this play is.
And definitely the opportunity to play a historical figure like Albert Parsons is important also because of the labor issues, because that is my heritage. My ancestor, our work came over from Ireland and Germany and moved to Chicago right after this. And they were, like, my grandfather was a typesetter. So it's just kind of the ironies of it all. And then, of course, here we are. We're all union actors. We're all working with this what is now kind of a dying institution. I mean, the labor unions have lost so much strength, but still it's something that I feel very strongly about. And so to play this character is going to be – it's really going to mean a lot. And I know we're going to affect people, which is –
That's
basic,
the purpose of theater.
Exactly. It was exactly what I took the words out of my mouth. That is the idea,
is that
you know, people aren't going to walk out at intermission.
Right.
And there are a lot of people, or most people, when they ask me, what's your play about? And I start to tell them about Lucy and Albert Parsons. They've never heard of them. They were infamous at the time. They were written up in every newspaper. Everyone knew who they were, and they've disappeared. And so this is a way to revive them and also – and this cause was very – It was a dangerous thing. I mean, there was a lot of violence surrounding it. The railroad strike that went on during that time that they supported people in Pittsburgh were the militia, which was the what we know of now as the National Guard, shot into a crowd, killed women and children who were unarmed. Mm-hmm. This is our history, and we can't forget this part of our history.
Lorca Perez, artistic director and founder of Multistages, Melody Cooper, award-winning playwright and actress of Day of Reckoning, and Freedom Bradley, who played Albert Parsons Jr., Michael Canale, who played Albert Parsons Sr.
Special thanks to our engineers, Spida Blue Rida, and Ken Nash, co-producer and co-host of Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report.
Thank you for joining us on Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report.